I took very seriously Boardman Robinson's lecture about the need for artists to support and be supported by the community. I never passed up a commission if it gave me the opportunity to create something new, even if it was not very profitable.
Throughout her journey from Colorado Springs, where she studied under Boardman Robinson, to Jackson, where she would establish the celebrated Wolf Studio, Mildred Wolf lived by this guidance. As she forged an identity for herself in Jackson, hanging on to that advice yielded some credible work. Commissioned mosaic panels from St. Richard's Catholic Church, and a growing children's portraiture clientele.
Then, in 1956, a commission from Bridgeton businessman Ben Stevens would give Mildred Wolf another opportunity to harness the wisdom of Boardman Robinson. The Wolf and Stevens families had already developed a strong professional relationship, Carl through his portrait trade and Mildred through a large mural celebrating the Stevens family history in the timber industry. Then Ben Stevens had a new idea.
Ben came with his wife to see the progress of the portrait and visit the studio, and they were real interested in everything that was going on. And he came back later and he had hatched this idea out about the Four Freedoms.
He got it from that speech that Roosevelt talked about.
Yeah, Franklin Delano.
When he talked about the Four Freedoms, it just stuck with him.
A decade and a half later, FDR's Four Freedoms still resonated. And while the specific circumstances that served as the impetus of that speech might have changed, the fundamental principles themselves, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear, were still strikingly relevant, nationally and regionally. On one hand, the 50s offered vast economic opportunity for many Americans. Veterans returned home and opened businesses or found work in thriving industries. The American dream that they had fought for seemed attainable for many. While this idealized version of America was beamed into family living rooms through shows like I Love Lucy and later Leave It to Beaver, the hard truth was that there was still much want, much to fear, and a systemic effort to silence many.
The conclusion of World War II presented a clash of undercurrents that shaped post-war America. VE Day brought an end to the imperial threat of Germany and the violent oppression of the Holocaust. But it also amplified the strength of the Soviet Union and influence of communism. As the 40s turned into the 50s, the fear of a nuclear-capable Soviet Union and the rise of communism had an incapacitating effect on the socio-political fabric of the United States. This manifested itself in the form of a second Red Scare led by Senator Joseph McCarthy and included House hearings on, quote, un-American activities and the blacklisting of artists.
Also included in this dynamic post-war America was a landmark decision in Brown v. Board of Education and the sweeping Southern response to that decision. A year following the Supreme Court's ruling, in Mildred's childhood state of Alabama, Rosa Parks' refusal to move to the back of the bus would spring the Montgomery bus boycotts and the dawn of the Civil Rights Movement. Much like it was in 1941, a schism still existed between the lofty rhetoric of the Four Freedoms and the degree to which they were protected. To the extent that Mildred Wolf considered the entirety of these intertwining factors is not exactly known. But what is known is that she, in the footsteps of Boardman Robinson, saw an opportunity to make art that spoke.
My mother had thought of the commission itself. I mean, she was charmed by the whole story and the fact that they're in the country store and all of that. But I think more than that, she was... It was significant to her, the subject, the theme, and her chance to do something in a big, you know, public scale like that, I think was really significant to her. It was like, oh, you know, I got to do that, you know.
So with the encouragement and backing of Ben Stevens, she set forth to give new voice to the Four Freedoms. Four Freedoms is brought to you in partnership with the Mississippi Museum of Art. Located in the heart of downtown Jackson, it is the largest art museum in the state and offers programming for patrons of all ages. And the best part, admission to the museum, its exhibitions, and its beautiful gardens is free. So check it out and visit www.msmuseumart.org for more info.
Welcome to Four Freedoms. I'm Ryan Davis.
And I'm Michael Guidry. Chapter 4, Everything Changes. This is part 1 of a 2-part chapter. Both parts of this chapter should already be available in your feed. Throughout this episode, as it was in previous chapters, you'll be hearing the words of Mildred Wolfe brought to life by Marie Venters. Again, these excerpts are possible through special permission by the University Press of Mississippi.
Art wasn't just to pretty up somebody's living room to go with their couch. It was, you know, something that could speak, you know, out in the world. And she would take any kind of commission that had a public aspect to it, whatever it paid.
Again, this is B.B. Wolfe, Mildred and Carl's daughter.
So she was charmed by his idea and you know, also, like I say, absolutely serious about it, executing it same way, you know, very, took it absolutely seriously, you know, the expression of it. So, and he provided those panels.
Those panels. The commission Mildred Wolfe received from Ben Stevens was not to simply paint a new version of the Four Freedoms. What Ben Stevens wanted was bigger than that, literally. He wanted Mildred to paint each of the Four Freedoms on a panel of Masonite, the same manufactured hardboard that he'd been supplying pulpwood for since the 1920s.
Each panel of Masonite was 4 feet wide and over 8 feet tall. The size was an important factor. Ben Stevens didn't intend to hide these away in his home. These were for his store, more specifically, the patrons of his store. This wasn't a vanity project. This was public art, the type of opportunity Boardman Robinson urged of his disciples.
When you came into the door, we had an old dry goods store on one side and a grocery store. Have you ever been to Williamsville in Philadelphia?
This is the voice you heard earlier, and it belongs to Richard Toms, grandson of Ben Stevens. Michael and I met up with three of Ben Stevens' grandsons at the Mississippi Museum of Art to discuss their grandfather's role in these paintings. Joining Richard were Joel and David Toms.
But anyway, we had an old-timey, had the dry goods on one side, had the grocery store and the meat market in the back. Behind it, we had an alleyway, and then we had a large hardware store. And then across the road, Granddaddy had a fertilizer shed. He sold fertilizer and John Deere tractors. And then we had a lumber shed, and we sold lumber and all that.
Wow. So, back then, they called that an old mercantile store.
And he had one of the largest in the South.
One of the most important things we learned during this meeting with the Toms was the extensive reach of this mercantile operation.
Yeah,
and it had an ice plant.
It had an ice plant.
Yeah, a cotton gin.
The other voice you hear now is David Toms.
So he was probably the largest. At one time, he probably sold more Levi jeans than anybody in Mississippi, literally. Because people would come from all over because they didn't. That's when Levi jeans were really, really popular, and people would come from Hattiesburg and Laurel and everywhere else just to get their Levi jeans.
Stores like the one Ben Stevens owned became little economic hubs during this period. They were centers for both economic and social exchange.
So it's a representation of local culture and talent and occupation and livelihood.
Once again, Dr. Stephanie Rolfe of Millsaps College.
At the same time, the mercantile store represents an exotic away, you know, where there are goods being shipped in, you know, toys and books and things like that, that are increasingly coming from overseas. So it's not only a connection to the rural and to the local, but it's a connection to the nation and to the world.
One of the unusual things about the store, he sold pulpwood, bought pulpwood, sold it. Yeah. And the people that brought him pulpwood, they'd get a ticket, a written ticket on how much. Tickets would be taken to the officer behind store.
The office where these, you know, back people. In here where the ladies work, and they paid off.
And people would come in on Saturday and buy their groceries and their jeans and their hardware, bring all those tickets around to the store. They would take the pulpwood tickets and the purchase tickets, sort of measure them up, and if the store owed them some money, they'd pay them in cash. If the people owed them, they'd put it on a credit ticket. And they could pay it the next week.
What they're describing is a pretty foreign concept in today's marketplace. What existed was a true exchange in a way that it created a real synergy within the community, and that synergy yielded a certain level of communal trust.
So it's curious to think about the images of these four paintings in a store where community is so critical, because there is, you're seeing an individual represented, But at the same time, there's a recognition in a place like a mercantile store that one of our, you know, our survival is dependent on each other and each other's benevolence and trust. And that's something that really strikes me, if, you know, in the image or the imagination of walking into that store, knowing that you need certain things, and you may not be able to cover it with cash. And so you rely on the benevolence and the trust of the clerk to issue you credit with the, they're, you know, they are trusting that you are going to circle back and pay it off.
When you consider Boardman Robinson's plea to his students to support and be supported by the community and to create art that had a voice, the B.M. Stevens store was an ideal space for this type of endeavor. It would bring art to a public audience.
These mercantile stores are such vibrant community centers that I think, you know, so much of the community would have been migrating in and out of there. So access, first of all, and exposure to a cultural contribution, which raises consciousness about the artistic imagination, which is something that people in rural Mississippi, you know, wouldn't have had as much access to.
With this bold new commission secured, the next step for Mildred Wolfe was to create. She had the spirit to generate a work that fiercely reflected the subject and the times. And as an artist in tune with the trends and styles of the larger art community, she studied.
We've spent a lot of time at the Mississippi Museum of Art throughout the making of this podcast. We've had the opportunity to explore the galleries and experience some of the amazing programming the museum has to offer. In fact, the museum offers a wide variety of year-round educational programs for both children and adults. First, there's Museum After Hours, a family-friendly cornucopia of art, social engagement, and education. Their Hoot and Holler Family Creation Lab brings 6 to 10-year-olds and their families into the galleries and classroom to look at and create art together. For kids 5 and under, there's Look and Learn with Hoot. It emphasizes creative play and literacy through story time and hands-on art activity. On top of that, each spring and fall, the museum hosts Family Day, a Saturday morning filled with art making, story time, music, dance, and games that all connect to the artwork in the gallery. To see a full schedule of these family-friendly events and classes, as well as a complete list of exhibitions, visit msmuseumart.org.
The 1950s brought with it the rise of abstract impressionism. If you've ever seen a Jackson Pollock, then you can get a sense of what abstract impressionism looks like. Needless to say, this wasn't exactly a style that fit the typical intentions of Mildred Wolfe. But she did recognize a value in the painterly qualities and energy of that approach. So she let it inform her vision. This wouldn't just be a new version of the Four Freedoms, but also her reaction to the visual dialogue that was occurring in her professional world.
So that was a response to what was happening in the art world, but it was her own. It was her own response. She wasn't trying to copy anybody, and she never took it to the level of just paint, you know. No subject. It was always in the service of expressing something about something.
In addition to determining style and composition, there was the subject matter itself.
That I know she studied the subject, because she'd always did. She always would study what other people had done. She'd look at things, see how it'd been interpreted. But she would always come to her own idea, you know, in the end, and then her own way of executing it.
She was equipped with a passion and vision for the project. She evoked her memories from her days in New York and the homeless men in the park. She hearkened back to her time in Colorado during the war and the war art that garnished recognition. She was given these massive panels of Masonite on which to paint each of the freedoms. She had all the tools, both material and intangible, to create. But space for such a large project was hard to come by.
I remember her doing it. I think I was 8 years old when she painted those. And she didn't have a place at the studio to work. There was one room in the house that had a north window, a double north window. We didn't have a high one, but it had a north window. And my parents always worked with natural light. They didn't ever paint with artificial light at all. So she took that room, and she had the panels, the windows were here, and she had the panels sort of leaning up against the wall and a little stepladder next to it so she could get up and down to the top and the bottom.
Painting each of the freedoms took months. As she observed her mother during this process, the strength of the imagery that her mother was producing had a profound impact on Bibi.
And I remember, what I most remember about her painting them is the Freedom from Fear panel, because it scared me. It really frightened me. I mean, it was, went in that room and and this was at the time of, for me, at the time of, coincided with all the worry and the duck and cover and the Cuban Missile Crisis and all that, which I remember scaring the hell out of me when I was young. It really did. You know, that whole thought of all of that happening. So I remember her having to comfort me and reassure me about that, the subject matter in that painting, tell me that that was all okay and it wasn't going to happen.
Mildred Wolfe completed the four panels in 1959, 3 years after Ben Stevens pitched the idea to her. The results were captivating and a complete departure from the previous interpretations of the Four Freedoms. A series of striking colors, powerful lines, and compelling images.
I think the colors are really, really striking. They're really bold and bright. And I also think they really match the individual freedom that each panel is referencing.
This is Isabel Gray, the James and Madeline McMullen Director of School and Academic Programs at the Mississippi Museum of Art.
So in the Freedom of Speech panel, you have bright yellows, and she says that that is supposed to kind of invoke sunlight and like the dawning of a new day, and you get the newsboy with the paper. So it all kind of ties in together. Whereas the Freedom from Fear is more, you know, dark blues, purples, red. Evokes a totally different feeling than that yellow does.
Trying to summarize these paintings is a futile exercise. No description, however well crafted, can really do them any justice. But given our particular medium here, allow us to indulge you as best we can. Freedom of Speech, as Isabel already highlighted, is a stark shift from the more renowned version Norman Rockwell painted in the 1940s. It depicts a young newsboy with print in hand raised above his head, the yellows and blues inviting. Freedom of Worship captures that influence of abstract impressionism, revealing two praying figures amidst an assortment of strong lines and deep hues of red, blue, and green. The effect gives the impression of a stained glass window. The third and fourth freedoms is where Mildred Wolfe's interpretation takes the sharpest turn. Rather than representing a world absent of want and fear, she elevates those concerns to the height of our consciousness. Freedom from Want recalls her experience in New York Central Park and centers the focus on a solitary man, forlorn and weary, the mix of greens, blues, and yellows eliciting a degree of melancholy and sympathy. Finally, Freedom from Fear, an arresting blend of color and imagery. Partially motivated by her previous work, Warsaw, London, Coventry, it encapsulates the horrors of war not on the front lines, but in our most vulnerable manner, at home. Instead of two parents placidly tucking their child into bed, Mildred Wolfe's Freedom from Fear draws on her maternal qualities and displays a mother anxiously shielding her children from the destructive forces of the air raid in the distance. What these series of paintings represent are not only a new reflection of the Four Freedoms, but also a new voice for Mildred Wolfe in Mississippi. Her previous works, the landscapes, the children's portraits, were mainly intended for private display. Even the mosaics for St. Richard's were commissioned for a specific audience. But these were different.
Well, I think they were not meant to live in homes, first of all. So much of her work was meant to live in private homes, either the portraits or the landscapes. You know, these were meant to be monumental public pieces. And so the language that she uses in them is that of public art.
This is Betsy Bradley, director of the Mississippi Museum of Art.
So their scale is different. The visual art language is very different. The messaging, of course, is meant to be part of the public discourse and civic dialogue that's going on with people who visit and look and explore these works. I think she's using that kind of abstracted vocabulary, bold, bright, rich coloration that grabs your attention as you're walking by. It's not something meant to soothe you or calm you. It's meant to arrest you.
With the panels completed, they were soon shipped to Richton to become that public message Ben Stevens and Mildred Wolf envisioned. Meanwhile, Mildred, like any artist, moved on to the next endeavor. While the Freedoms were an ambitious affair and a personally significant work, she wasn't expecting them to bring her a measure of esteem.
An artist goes on one track and you know, what they produce and what happens to it, it's on a totally different, you know, so it's a totally different track. So an artist always, when they feel like they've done something significant, you know, is always has within them, I think, the fact that this is significant, I did this, and this is significant. End of story. And then there's what happens to it, you know, and I think that my mother, the what happens to it probably was not as important to her as the fact that she did it and that they speak, that the paintings actually speak, you know, and are powerful things. And I think that that's probably what, to her, she was proudest of.
Even though it might not have been of tremendous concern to Mildred Wolf, we do know what happened to the paintings. The B.M. Stevens store would be their home until the mid-1980s, when the store closed. During their life there, they did what Mildred had intended them to do. They spoke. After that, they were moved to the Perry County Courthouse under the guidance of the Stevens family, and were kept there until 2014. They remained, as was their purpose, in public view. While the paintings and their transcendent message stand on their own merit, within the undercurrent of their substance was the artist herself.
When you think about, especially starting in the 19th century and moving forward, that women's work tended to be small scale. It tended to be in the relatively minor media, like watercolors, was seen as appropriate for women, even though watercolor is really hard. But still, it was seen as a sort of softer, gentler medium than oil and certainly than fresco or sculpture. And also that it tended to be for a more private or domestic or intimate settings.
This is Dr. Elise Smith, professor of art history and the Sanderson Chair in Arts and Sciences at Millsaps College.
So this issue of going public with larger scale works is very much tied in with political ideas about women's roles. And those, of course, were changing very much in the 20th century and very much connected with the impact of World War I and World War II, with women starting to, you know, having to work, wanting to work during the war. And then what happens when the men come back and they no longer have the jobs? And so the 50s as a decade is such an interesting decade because there's this conservatism, a retrenchment of conservative ideals post-World War II. But at the same time, a lot of women who are saying, oh, maybe not. Maybe I really want to continue to have the kind of voice that I had earlier.
Mildred Wolf, deliberately or not, was resisting this restoration of antiquated gender expectations. Whether it be through her self-willed autonomy as an artist or her quiet reluctance to conform to a presumed role, she resisted being categorized and regarded as merely a woman or a wife. But those archaic views reached farther and wider than she anticipated. This is the end of Chapter 4, Part 1. The conclusion of our story can be found in Chapter 4, Part 2, which is live now. Four Freedoms is brought to you by PK Media with support from the Mississippi Museum of Art. It was researched by Michael Guidry and Ryan Davis, written by me, Michael Guidry, produced by Sonny Sweat, editing and sound engineering by Ed Foos, original title score and composition by Steve Smith. It was recorded at PK Media Studios in Jackson, Mississippi. We would like to thank Marie Venters for lending her voice to give life to Mildred Wolf's words, Excerpts featured in this episode were made possible through cooperation with the University Press of Mississippi. We would like to extend our deepest gratitude to Bebe Wolf for her time and invaluable insight during the making of this series. We also encourage you to visit the Wolf Studio on Old Canton Road in Jackson to experience and celebrate the artistic contributions of the entire Wolf family. We would like to recognize Richard Joel and David Toms for their support and involvement in this story. We would also like to thank Dr. Stephanie Rolfe and Dr. Lee Smith of Millsaps College, as well as Isabel Gray and Betsy Bradley of the Mississippi Museum of Art for their contributions to this episode. For more information about this episode, visit 4freedoms.pkpods.com. That's the number 4freedoms.pkpods.com. To experience the 4 Freedoms paintings in person, we encourage you to visit the Mississippi Museum of Art. Admission is free. Or visit their website, www.msmuseumart.org. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe through Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to support what we do, then please share, subscribe, and leave a review. That's all for now, but we urge you to continue to check your feed for upcoming bonus material.